This is the second hour of We the People Radio, today on June 2nd, 2024. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. And if you're looking for a mower, a tractor, implements, any kind of yard care products, go up and see them. They've got all that equipment in stock and ready to go. They've got all your electric riding equipment, handheld equipment. It's all there. Go up and see them. They also have a fully trained parts and service department. They can fix most anything up there. And they're located in the city of Shasta Lake, or you can give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226, or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Mm-hmm.
There you are.
Where you can get all those mandated electric...
That's right. We follow the law. And the law says you have to buy electric. So you come up and see us. We'll sell you an electric one.
We'll sell you electric stuff.
That's right.
You guys have a lot of electric stuff. You got handheld stuff.
Yep. We got all the trimmers and edgers and weed whackers, or as they say in Australia, the whippersnippers.
The whippersnippers.
Yeah. We have those. They've got electric riders. They've got it all going on right now. And the tractors, thank goodness, right now are still all diesel-powered. So you can still get your diesel-powered John Deere tractor. So go up and see them.
Nice. Well, that's what we talked about the first hour, just in case you missed that part, was the mandates to have gas-powered cars in the next few years, even though the manufacturers are saying they can't do it. That doesn't matter. The government's telling them they have to and telling us we have to buy them. So,
yep. The time. Build it and they will come.
The time to
get it. You won't be able to drive it because you won't be able to charge it. But
No. And here we'll be having a brownout, so it won't matter.
You'll be first. You'll feel good at being the first to save the planet.
Exactly.
That's right.
Yeah. All our topics are frustrating.
Be a leader.
All our topics are frustrating, but we'll make fun of every single one of them. Darn it. Just to make it all work.
You know, I had a customer come in the other day. Had a electric vehicle, and I said, hey, how do you like that? Oh, I love it. He goes, it's just great. He goes, I haven't been at a gas station for months. And I said, well, good for you. I said, have you taken it anywhere? Oh, yeah, we drove it to Wyoming or someplace. I said, well, how'd that go? Oh, it went fine. Yeah, we didn't have any problem. I said, well, did you, what route did you take? Well, we had to take, we only had a couple of choices there because we had to stay on the route that had the charger. So we couldn't venture off too far. But other than that, it was a great trip.
Other than you didn't get to go where you wanted.
Yeah. Other than that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln? ridiculous.
We're turned into dogs now. We can only go as long as that little expando leash goes.
That's right. Then it's, snaps back, and you got to get back there and charge
Mom's
it.
Mom's got a new expando leash. It's like 8 feet long.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
It's great.
God. Well, Dr. Judith Curry, she is the president and co-founder of Climate Forecast Applications Network, CFAN for short. She is a professor emerita at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where she served as chair of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences for 13 years. Her expertise is in climate dynamics, extreme weather, and prediction and predictability. She's a fellow of the American Meteorological Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, actual science, and the American Geophysical Union. So we have had Dr. Curry on here. There is more to this story. We have had her on our show several times.
I remember her.
Oh, and my bad.
She's the heretic.
She is the heretic. And my bad is I didn't link the previous shows, but I'll get on that right now, right this minute while we're talking. But she was the first person that came to mind while I watched Mayor Pete wax poetic about how turbulence is caused by climate change and a bunch of other dumb stuff. And I knew we were talking about electric cars. And so I said to myself, we have to have Dr. Curry back on, talk to us about some turbulence, since she's actually an expert on extreme weather. So, Dr. Curry, have you recovered from watching Mayor Pete on the news? You probably had to take Maalox or some other stronger
Xanax,
whiskey, something.
Yeah, I had some fun on Twitter and all that sort of forced me to dig into what was going on here. And you won't be surprised, but Mayor Pete was way off base.
What? Mayor Pete? You mean Mayor Pete's not a real climate scientist?
Yeah, well, okay. There's three types of turbulence that can impact aircraft. Okay, one is like mountain-induced. If you, like I live in Reno, Nevada, right near the Sierra Nevadas, and if you've ever tried to, you know, go in for a landing near Reno, it is very, very, very bumpy because those mountains generate waves that cause up and down. So that's a common cause of turbulence that airplanes need to worry about. The other one is deep convective towers, big thunderstorms. I'm sure you've flown over thunderstorms and felt a really bumpy ride.
Oh, yeah.
It can be a bit scary. And then there's a third category, which is clear air turbulence. You know, there's no mountains, there's no deep convection, and it's just related to what's going on the dynamics of the upper atmosphere. In the vicinity of the jet stream, and this is something that's, you know, in the upper atmosphere around, you know, 30 to 40,000 feet, it's a big band of very fast winds traveling from west to east at very high speeds. And, you know, this changes its location. Sometimes it's wavy, sometimes it's straight, whatever. But associated with the jet stream is a lot of turbulence, you know, at the boundaries. And, you know, and you can sometimes actually get clear air turbulence that gives the planes quite a jolt, especially, you know, like traveling from New York or Boston over to Western Europe. You know, you're right in the path, you know, of the jet stream. So what Mayor Pete was talking about was claiming that clear air turbulence is increasing because of global warming. Okay, and there is a paper out there that, well, a couple of papers on this subject, and they look at, I mean, well, how do you tell that it's clear air turbulence? Well, you can diagnose it, you know, from weather analyses related to wind shear and entropy, stretching deformation, and some of these dynamical fields to estimate where you should be seeing clear air turbulence. And looking at the weather analysis data, researchers spotted a trend since 1980 to present in the eastern U.S. and the North Atlantic. Okay, like maybe like a 20% increase in this clear air turbulence. Okay, so is this believable? It's not implausible.
Okay.
But that there would be an increase since 1980. I mean, it's a little bit of sleight of hand. You've got to make a lot of assumptions before you conclude that. But we're talking about 20%. So if this is real, do you blame it on global warming or the fact that the Atlantic multidecadal oscillation index has increased from 1980 to the present?
I don't remember him talking about that.
No, that's another possible explanation, especially since you see this over the Atlantic Ocean. So that's another possible explanation. But if you, but to me, the bigger picture is like, over the U.S., have we seen any increase in turbulence incidents that are reported by airlines? I spotted some statistics from whatever it is, Safety Transport Board, it must be under Mayor Pete somewhere, showed that since 1988, the number of reported incidents for turbulence impacting aircraft, and this is all kinds of turbulence, clear air, mountain waves, deep convection, there's no trend. And this is even more surprising since the number of flights over that period, since 1988, over the U.S. has increased substantially. So there's no evidence of increased turbulence impacting aircraft. So, you know, what are we to make of this? Well, okay, in this particular instance of the Singapore Airlines, the Singapore is already the transportation ministry or whatever it's called over there. They've done a preliminary analysis. What happened is the aircraft was subject to a big boom. I mean, it gained a lot of altitude, you know, like several thousand feet in a very short time and a forward acceleration. And so the pilots tried to compensate by bringing the aircraft down. And so it was those two things that, you know, that gave it the big jolt. Now, they were close to Myanmar, and there are radars, you know, off the coast of India that, you know, was covering that region. And there was definitely, you know, storms, thunderstorms in the region. So it's not too far-fetched, you know, to think that this was particular instance was related to a big thunderstorm updraft that caused that turbulence. It's consistent with the accelerometer data from the aircraft itself. So it looks like it was old-fashioned, you know, thunderstorm causing,
what?
You know, bumpy aircraft.
It was weather? Oh, no.
Yeah, so it was, I mean, you know, so this is so far what it looks like. It was basically a thunderstorm. And, you know, the weather radar data in that part of the world isn't as sophisticated as what you have, you know, in the U.S. or Western Europe or whatever, but it's enough to tell you that there it was stormy, and they just got unlucky where they, you know, flew, you know, they got caught by a big updraft, and I guess some passengers didn't have their seatbelts fastened, and then that's why we had even a casualty. So, you know, it's not unusual, but there's no evidence that turbulence is increasing. So, you know, Mayor Pete is really off base on that one. what they need is, you know, better sensors on the aircraft so they can, you know, sense what's up ahead and, you know, really have to enforce that, you know, seatbelt thing. Because, you know, everybody starts off with their seatbelts, and then they leave them on until they get up to go to the bathroom or something. And then when they get back in their seat, they may not put them back on.
Sure.
And, you know, that failure is, you know, what might have been fatal in this particular instance.
Well, I heard later that the fatality on that flight was actually a heart attack. It wasn't from an injury from hitting the roof or flying out of his seat. No, it was a
heart. Oh, my gosh. Okay.
It was a heart attack.
That's even better.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, and this is a problem. When we blame everything on climate change, it gives us, it's like a cop-out for not dealing with the real problems. Okay, we need better sensors on the aircraft so they can monitor, you know, the weather environment in real time, not just relying on, you know, air traffic control or whatever and radio reports. They need to be able to monitor it in real time. And whenever you're flying through convection, it may not seem too bad, but can always be a surprise, you know, a deep power that pops up and surprises you. So rather than, you know, blame climate change and, oh, my gosh, if only we'd stop burning fossil fuels, there would be no more clear air turbulence. You know, that we need to have better sensors on the aircraft so they can have better situational awareness.
Well, I think that's, you know, what you were saying about let's blame it on climate change. It seems like any disaster, you know, foul weather, you know, all these tornadoes we're having, hurricanes, they're all being blamed. Or at least the increase is being blamed on climate change. You know, how much truth is there to those stories? I mean, that hurricanes are more intense and more frequent, and tornadoes are more intense and more frequent. Are those stories true?
No, not at all. you know, this year has been a bad tornado year in the U.S. and we're just getting started. There's more to the season. But until this year, there had been an overall decline for decades in the number of tornadoes in the U.S. So this year is a big uptick.
Yeah.
Okay, but
hold that thought, and let's come back on tornadoes. Darn, I've got a good song on tornadoes, and dang it. Maybe I can get it. Maybe I can get it for the second half. We've got to take a quick break. It's just my crisis. I aired for you all.
Yeah, thanks for that.
Feels like shaking his head. Why are you saying this? Oh my goodness! Our guest is Dr. Judith Curry, and we were helping you with turbulence. You can go about your lives now. Global warming is not causing turbulence. We're all free to move about the cabin, but as soon as we sit down, put your seatbelt on. That's what we've learned.
Because there was an earthquake in L.A. today, and that could have been climate change as well. So
you should just hope you were in an airplane with your seatbelt
on. Strap in your recliner too.
Such a bunch of Weisenheimers. We'll be right back. Though we're gonna talk about tornadoes. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
So take my soul. That's what you said. But who are we to know?
You never disappoint.
There you go, Mayor Pete. There's your tornado. I knew I had a song about tornadoes. So we've had fewer tornadoes, but
in the last few years.
Am I starting to guess what they're up to? Are they going to tell us that this is the most we've ever had, like in a million years or something?
I think that's a hard one to pull off. I mean, there's been a lot of really big seasons, like especially in the 70s. Again, when I was in graduate school, again, I was at University of Chicago. One of the faculty members was Ted Fujita, Mr. Tornado. He invented all those tornado scales and all of this kind of stuff. So I was, you know, really into the tornado thing. But, the 70s was really bad time for tornadoes. You know, the last decade has really been pretty benign. Last two decades even been pretty benign for tornadoes. I mean, this is a big year, but very, very far from a record-breaking year, and it's certainly not part of a trend. This year, we've had some weird weather patterns. I mean, in May, we had that huge heat dome over Mexico, the Gulf of Mexico, and the southern states, Florida, Miami. Just insane heat. Okay, broke a number of records in Miami. This is big heat dome. You know, it's starting to, you know, move north and whatever now. It's finally breaking up, but it's just part of natural weather variability. At the same time, the heat dome in the western U.S., we've been cool. We've had anomalously cool weather in May. In Reno, Nevada, where I live, I mean, we've only had a few days that have, you know, made it to the 80s so far, so we've been very cool. So you have this cool air mass in the west and the big heat dome to the south, and, you know, the circulation patterns associated with those two things, it's a bad recipe for the Great Plains and the Midwestern states in terms of severe weather. And so they're just cranking out the severe weather in late May. But, you know, those patterns are changing. And, you know, we'll see what, you know, the weather roulette table has in store for us. But, you know, there's no trend in tornadoes. And even the UN Climate Assessment Report acknowledges that there's been no trend in tornadoes and no reason to expect an increase in tornadoes from global warming. So that one's really pretty much off the table.
I'm still going to put some money on that one. I am, because they love doing that, and they know nobody's going to go do the homework. They're going to tell everybody that don't listen to Dr. Judith Curry. She's a climate heretic. She's looking at facts. She's using science.
Yeah. Well, and the like, rest of us like are all the president just, said, we'll take truth over facts any day. I mean, come on.
Well, and we're just all a bunch of dummies driving not electric cars, right? So what do we know? We, yeah.
Okay, well, now hurricanes.
Uh-oh, here we go.
Okay, but this is the big story.
Okay.
Everybody is predicting a blowout. Well, almost everybody's predicting a blowout year for hurricanes
no
in the Atlantic. Okay. The reasons are we have extremely warm temperatures in the tropical Atlantic and the Caribbean and now the Gulf. And we're headed towards a La Nina. Okay, both of these things are recipes for a bad season. There are some mitigating factors that my forecast team looks at, so we're not expecting as huge a blowout as some other people are forecasting, but it's going to be an extremely active year anyway you slice it. So how much of this is global warming? Well, there are some simple theories that say that with warmer sea surface temperatures, you should get more intense hurricanes. Okay, but those theories don't do a very good job on the moist thermodynamics of hurricanes. And I was just reading a paper today on this, you know, showing, you know, how there's a penalty to warmer sea surface temperatures in terms of the kinetic energy, the mechanical energy of the hurricanes and the maximum wind speed. So this is, you know, there's hypotheses out there that we should have stronger hurricanes in a warmer climate. But the data is so noisy. There's so much year-to-year variability. The signals are very hard to tease out. You know, in some regions, you can maybe tease out a signal. But is that multi-decadal natural climate variability or the global warming trend? You know, it's hard to separate out. Now, the interesting thing is that most climate models actually predict fewer hurricanes in a warming climate.
Okay. Really?
Maybe more intense, but fewer hurricanes.
Oh.
Yeah, so, you know, so there you have it. But the signal will be small enough that it's not of both, is really not going to make any difference, you know, given the year-to-year variability. The one signal, and this is what I would expect from this year with the very warm sea surface temperatures, is that when something does hit land, it'll be carrying a lot of water and it will rain a lot. You know, even tropical storms, the weaker systems, you know, if they're moving slow enough, they can produce big floods. So I think in terms of landfalls, my company is predicting 4 U.S. landfalls this year, with the focus in the Gulf of Mexico, unfortunately. So I think we are going to see significant number of landfalls this year. But I think that hopefully there's not going to be any extremely strong ones like we. But I think there will be a lot of rain. So this is going to be a bad hurricane year. There's no way around it, but attributing any of this to global warming is really pretty dubious. There is some evidence, both in observations and just from general theory, that we should expect more rain. with the warmer sea surface temperatures, that's plausible. But again, the data is so noisy, and it's very hard to compare individual storms and individual locations because there's so much variability. But if global warming was associated with more rainfall from hurricanes, that wouldn't surprise me. Mm. We've had, the worst U.S. landfalling hurricanes were in the 1930s. Big one hitting Florida and a big one hitting New England. I mean, these are the two record holders. We've seen some bad ones, certainly in the 21st century. But in terms of, the big record breakers for U.S. landfalls, it really was in the 1930s, believe it or not. It's going to be a bad year this year. And I think everybody's prepared for it, at least all the emergency management and the electric utilities and the insurance companies. Everybody's, as prepared as they can be. It's up to individual people, to secure their personal and household safety.
Sure. So if they stop driving their car, it's not going to magically fix it, though. Bottom line.
The bottom line is, apart from heat waves that have some of, obvious association with global warming, the other extreme events, they simply do not correlate with, an increasing global average temperature. I mean, they don't. I mean, a lot of really bad weather, in the 1900s, it was, significantly cooler than it is now. The worst atmospheric river and floods in California, that was, in 1861, 1862. The stuff simply does not scale with global average temperature apart from heat waves. Mm. But the good news is that the cold events are declining. Fewer cold outbreaks, and more people die from cold events than from heat events by an order of magnitude. You never hear that.
That's awkward, right?
I don't know. So, this whole thing about using extreme weather events and blaming them on global warming, the people are trying, it's propaganda, really, trying to amp up the alarm and the urgency for getting rid of fossil fuels. And the real irony of this, if we start jeopardizing our electricity supply, we're going to increase our vulnerability to extreme weather. If we have tons of electricity, we can pump water, and we can have desalination plants, and we can, protect our infrastructure and this, that, and the other. If we don't have electricity and if we're poverty-stricken, we're going to be a lot more vulnerable to whatever Mother Nature throws at us. So our first line of defense is abundant and reliable electricity. That's our first line of defense for extreme weather.
Well, yeah, because, low resources and, by way of fuels and all that, that was the pre-industrial era, and those are lots of third world countries. And as soon as we figured out energy production, it all opened up. Why? Any thought besides, your basic power and control and evilness? Like, why would they want to put us back to a pre-industrial period by all this lying and scaring and, trying to walk you into your prison cell and, cement in your own bars and lock the door on yourself? Like, what's the point?
Well, there's a world out there, that the environment comes first and that it's very fragile and that humans are a blight on the environment. And we would really be better off if there were a lot less humans and they didn't use resources and this, that, and the other. I mean, it's sort of a neo-Malthusian mindset, if that word means anything to you. And it's, there is that mindset, and then there's also power and control. I mean, all of this alarm about the environment, it's a pretext for, you know, non-government world control by the United Nations. And you know, this has been, you know, their dream for decades. They're trying to do it with the World Health Organization as well as the climate change issue. And the World Health Organization thing, whereby the WHO controls all the pandemic responses and this, that, and the other, there's a lot of backlash against that. And I think there's growing backlash against all these, you know, UN rules and regulations. So, you know, it's power, control, and just a worldview of, you know, this neo-Malthusian worldview of the environment comes first, you know, and humans are a blight on the planet, that I think is driving this. It sounds stupid, but there's a long history, you know, going back to the 1950s, you know, in the UN and the Rockefeller Foundation and all this kind of stuff. We've been developing these ideas and pushing it, and, you know, all the while, you know, certain people make a lot of money and gain a lot of power, and they preach morality, and a lot of people fall for it. And, you know, it's a complicated situation in terms of how we got to this rather stupid place. But I think we need to do more work to understand how we got here if we're going to have any chance of unraveling it.
Yeah. I would imagine and we've spoken with you about this before, but this is annoying for those of us who are not scientists. You know, we can't really tell you why turbulence it isn't global warming, but we know it's not. If you actually know the facts, this has to be one of those things where you probably have to just like turn the TV off or, you know, shut these people off and take a breath every now and then. Gotta be just frustrating as hell.
Yeah, it's I don't know what drives, you know, but people are tuning out because a lot of it doesn't make sense. And like last year, the temperature breached the 1.5 degrees centigrade threshold that people, you know, of warming since pre-industrial times that we were told was, you know, existential crisis, highway to climate hell, you know, code red alert. And, okay, well, nothing bad happened.
Oops.
Okay. Yeah, well, we had some heat waves. But other than that, the hurricanes globally were very tame. You know, there were no big, huge floods or droughts or, you know, it was a pretty normal year. You know, in spite of the fact that we breached the 1.5 degree centigrade threshold. So people are saying, okay, well, so what? You know, like maybe I should put this one on the shelf and worry about something else. I think they overplayed their hand with all this alarm and all these thresholds of disaster. And once we pass those thresholds and nothing bad happens, people start to roll their eyes.
It seems like that's always the play, though, is do the scare and gloom and doom, and, you know, 1.5 degrees is, that's going to be it. You know, we're going to, the point of no return. And then it happens and nothing happens. It's the same scenario over and over and over. And I think you're right. I think people are starting to kind of get wise to a lot of this and, using common sense that, you know, really, a degree and a half is going to melt the planet? No, it won't. It won't. So I think we need to take a break.
Well, we do, but I just sent him the songs because I was screwing around and wasn't paying attention. So, you know, full disclosure, I was having such a good time thinking about all the craziness. I got swept up in it.
Yeah,
I got carried away.
Craziness. I mean, I'll always go back to what was Al Gore's book?
I was just going to say, Bill has a total thing about Al Gore's book. He's like, everything in there is a lie.
It is. I want to do a show on that book and just take it point by point, because everything is past that was predicted in that book, and none of it came true. So the inconvenient truth.
Yeah. The inconvenient truth is that none of it was true.
Yeah, that's the inconvenient
part. It's an inconvenient title, really. Bill needs to write his own book.
Yeah, the inconvenient title.
The inconvenient title. I don't know how you show. I don't know how you keep showing up. I mean, that's like the height of hubris. Right?
Yeah.
You keep
yeah.
showing up at your climate conference when you've written a book about everything that has already not happened.
Yeah.
And you're the expert. I don't
know. All right. So.
All right. So, have I given you enough time in there, in the box? Are we good?
Oh, yeah, we're good.
Oh my
you.
God! We'll take a really quick break. We all better switch to decaf. Let's all switch to decaf, and we'll come right back with Dr. Judith Curry. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Oh, I just try to make believe that everything you're telling me is true. Come on, baby, won't you do it? Say the sea is rising. Well, that's alright with me. Cause there ain't no other place than on the sea I'd rather be. And that second coming's coming, it's right around the bend. And someday could be any day. This world is gonna end, but that's alright. That's okay. There ain't nothing we can do about the whole thing anyway. It's a hang-on kind of ride. We're spinning through space and time, rocking this big old rock, just trying to have some fun. So let's drink another beer. Here's to another year. Let's take another crazy trip around the sun.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but...
it's a crazy ride, that's for sure.
Yeah, I just wonder, how do these people go to these conferences and stuff and with a straight face? I mean, is it so far gone that that's just widely accepted?
Well, yeah, there's a big, you know, sort of groupthink mentality that's set in. I mean, the whole climate problem and policy solutions have been framed very narrowly, and everybody's working from within inside that narrow little box. And, you know, they're often dotting each other's I's and crossing each other's T's and not making any meaningful progress in understanding because they're sitting inside this little box. And until you step outside of that box and start looking at real natural weather and climate variability and a whole broad range of policy options and different decision-making frameworks, you'll never get anywhere. And that's what I tried to put out there in my book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk. I know we've talked about the book on my previous interviews, but it's
really... We should keep talking about it, though, because it's a good one.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, it's sort of, you know, how to step outside the box and take a much broader perspective about this issue. Speaking of my book, it's now available in audio book version, which was a long time coming, but it's out now, and I'm very happy about that.
Nice. Did you have to read it yourself, or did you get somebody to do it?
No, somebody, my publisher took care of that. I don't even know. I think it's probably some artificial intelligence type voice.
Nice. As long as it doesn't sound like the people that you get when your phone malfunctions and you have to call India. God bless you, God bless you, Indians, but, you know, there's enough of that. We don't want to hear a whole book.
Right. But, you know, but this is why everybody has just gotten so group thinking. And the urgency, you know, all the UN national leaders and whatever talking about the urgency of this. People just say, well, we don't have time to rethink this. We don't have time to think. We don't have time to develop new power generation options. You know, it's urgent. We don't have time to think. We just need to do. So it's this urgency, a sense of urgency that's making people stupid and make really poor decisions. And it also impacts, you know, the scientists, because the scientists, you know, the whole reward system for their careers is set up, you know, to amplify, you know, they will succeed if they amplify the alarm.
No, you're right. I think anytime they say anything is urgent and needs immediate change, it's usually the opposite. I mean, look at, I think it was AOC said we had 12 years before the whole thing comes crashing down. Well, I think we're halfway there, and I'm not sure the sea levels have risen at all since then.
They're creeping along at about 3 millimeters per year. What does 3 millimeters mean? Well, if you stack two pennies on top of each other.
Yeah, and we're not smart enough to mitigate that. That rise or recognize that level of increase and move all our cities off the coast
but
by a couple of miles.
At the same time that's happening, you have people like the Obamas that are buying mansions on the coastline. So it's like, what does that say? Well, I mean, I know what that says, but what does that say?
Yeah, and, the locations where they're... Some locations, you do measure a big sea level rise, but those locations are where the ground is sinking, okay, either from natural geologic processes or from groundwater withdrawal, just pumping out the groundwater, and building big cities on top of the soil that compresses things down. Like a lot of sea level rise near Louisiana, that's associated with actually the extraction of oil and gas from the land and also groundwater withdrawal. Okay, and so that's caused the land to sink. But worse yet, the way they engineered the Mississippi River, you don't get that sediment enrichment of the delta, the ongoing enrichment of the delta, which is sort of starving the delta of sediment. So, the coastline is disappearing. So there's humans are... causing a lot of sinking of the ground, and you blame it on sea level rise. Mm-hmm. But now the real killer is San Francisco, like the airport. I mean, that's built on landfill, and they're worried that it's sinking. Well, it's landfill. They didn't engineer the landfill very well.
Yeah, Venice much?
There's a lot of these places. Oh, in Indonesia... Jakarta, capital city, I mean, just sinking like crazy, like 22 feet a year or something is nuts.
Wow.
So we've actually moved the capital inland. So, a lot of this is man-made. When you look at a location where sea level rise is a problem, invariably it's some man-made actions that are substantially contributing to the problem.
Right, and I think that can be substantiated by looking at an area, say San Francisco, and they say, "Oh, the sea level rises." Well, sea level doesn't rise just in San Francisco, but not in San Jose, or not in Seattle
or San Diego.
It doesn't work that way. I mean, the whole Pacific Ocean would come up equally if it was a sea level change. I mean, am I off base there?
No, pretty good, but there's also ocean circulation patterns that cause the sea to pile up in one location or pull away from another location. For example, in the Pacific, the ocean circulation patterns act to pull the water away from the coast, so the sea level rises less on the Pacific coast, the U.S. Pacific coast, than the U.S. Atlantic coast, where the circulation patterns in the Atlantic tend to push the water towards the coast. So there's a lot of factors going on.
Right. And which that makes sense. I mean, that I can believe. Now, there's been a lot of talk lately about these glaciers cracking off and melting. Is what's the story there? Can you talk about that?
Okay, well, two places that are at issue: Greenland and then Antarctica. Looking at Greenland first, because the Greenland ice cap, was really big, say around 1850 or whatever. There's a huge amount of ice accumulation. And then you had all these ice shelves and whatever. And so as we have some warming, some of those are breaking off. And those do melt, and they do, you know, increase sea level rise. But at the same time, there's a lot of snowfall accumulating on Greenland. And so the mass balance of Greenland is how much snow falls, how much of it melts on the surface, and how much icebergs break off. And there's a lot of year-to-year variability. There's a lot of multi-decadal variability. The current sort of period for mass loss from Greenland started in about 1995. And this coincided when there was a big change in the Atlantic circulation patterns in the ocean and the atmosphere. So, I mean, this period of Greenland mass loss, I think, had a natural trigger, which was exacerbated by global warming. So there has been some, the mass loss from Greenland peaked in about 2010. Since then, the mass loss has slowed down quite a bit. And once we switch to the cold phase of the Atlantic circulation pattern, you know, we could even see a period of accumulation, or at least a bigger slowdown of the loss. So, you know, the Greenland situation is relatively stable. The biggest concern is really the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is a marine ice sheet. It's a small part of the Antarctic continent. But if you took away all the ice, the land would actually be underwater. Okay, so the fact that they have an ice sheet near the surface is that it extends from the big continental glacier out into the ocean. Okay, and so this is not a very stable situation. So the ice in this region moves pretty rapidly, and you're always getting big icebergs break off. So could something really bad happen to the West Antarctic ice sheet? Could it disappear? Well, it, you know, 119,000 years ago in the last interglacial, I think the West Antarctic ice sheet was smaller than it is now. So, I mean, that still, you know, could shrink more. But the real issue of concern in my mind is there's a bunch of under ice volcanoes that are heating this from below. Okay, but
gosh, why don't we talk about that more often?
I know.
Wonder.
I know. And then the other issue is that the West Antarctic ice sheet, it's pretty elastic, so when you lose some ice, it actually rises. You know, the geologic forces sort of rebound and it pushes it up. So I'm not very concerned about the West Antarctic ice sheet in the near term, but this is the one that gets all the hype. Mm-hmm. And if something was to really bad happen with sea level rise, it would come from the West Antarctic ice sheet, and probably more likely those under ice volcanoes.
You mean they would actually melt the ice?
From below. Yeah.
Well, be darned.
Huh.
Well, we can do something about that.
Stop driving right now, because that's gonna stop, and I'll stop using underarm deodorant or whatever it is we got to stop doing these days.
Right.
Oh, it was hairspray. Sorry, I got that confused.
You know, so natural climate variability, you know, can be pretty wild and crazy, and but that's completely ignored, you know, and we're just, you know, focused on, you know, global warming is really a slow creep. Like I said, 3 millimeters a year for, you know, sea level rise, and the glaciers melt a little bit, and it's just a slow creep, and it's something that we can easily adapt to. But, you know, they amp it up in trying to tie it to extreme weather events, which is really unjustified. Then they talk about tipping points. You know, once we get past this threshold,
that's right.
Boom,
that's right. Know, there's the point of no return.
That's the part that always gets me, and the part that I think most people should be wary of is the urgency and the tipping point. It's like once we hit that, all bets are off.
Guys, we have hit a tipping point. You know, that's a nice segue right there into the end right there, the end. Dr. Judith Curry, we love you. We think you're the best. And I think people should go to Climate Etc., her blog at judithcurry.com, and read her book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk.
Yeah, we're going to call you back as this thing develops.
This isn't going anywhere.
Sea level, you know, rises another foot. Well, we won't wait till it goes up a foot.
Coming back.
It'd be another million years.
All right,
years,
you can find us at We the People Radio. .us.
.us.
Ah, cheated.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back. Though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.